Today we have the privilege of having with us Bishop Todd Hunter. Todd has been our bishop for quite a few years now, and it's great to have him here with us. Todd's day job is actually, he is the pastor of Holy Trinity Anglican Church in Southern California, and as well, he is the adjunct professor at several seminaries. He is the author of many books, and in fact, is writing one now. When's the next one coming? We don't know. Yeah. He has planted or been a part of helping to plant probably dozens, is that fair to say? Dozens of churches. And his own church has already planted at least a couple of churches in California. And so aside from his duties as a bishop and the travel and all of that that entails, he's got a lot going on. And so, Todd, we're really glad that you're here with us and
Patrick,
to share with us. So
good to be here. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Well, I know it's Sunday morning, and we don't typically think of doing a little mental work on Sunday morning, so I got to tell you before we start this that I'm going to ask you to do a little mental work with me this morning. Ideas like clothing or music, they come and go, they come in and out of fashion. And these kind of mental fashions really dictate in culture what we should listen to, what we might consider, or what we ought to ignore. And in our culture today, the coolest thing to do, the best way to show you're smart and up to date, is to doubt. To say that you know anything today is often viewed as a form of intolerance. Like, you can't say you know anything, because if you say you know something that I think or feel differently about, well, now you've introduced tension into a marriage, a friendship, a society, and you then become an agent of intolerance or unpeace. So today, whether it's in academia or in a Starbucks or in a church, like, the best thing you could possibly do to show you're cool is to doubt or to not be sure about anything. You know, just the whole notion that we can't really know anything. And I sort of get that. I mean, can you hear somebody saying, okay, I know the speed of light, but what's the speed of dark? Have you ever thought about that? Or what about this one? What happens if you get scared half to death twice? At my church in Costa Mesa, we actually have a rocket scientist. And so I asked him the other day, if my car could travel the speed of light, would my headlights still work? I don't know. Well, John tells the story that Porter just read us in the gospel for the same reason he told all the signs and all the discourses in John, that you might believe. Not that you might show your concordance or your harmony with present culture and doubt, but that you might believe. Well, what sort of thing are we talking about when we talk about belief? Well, the first thing to say is that Thomas is not in this passage denying the resurrection. He's just simply saying, I've heard of what my friends said, and I actually trust my friends. I don't think they're lying to me. He's just saying, I want to go beyond this kind of hearsay or rumor to some sort of evidence or facts. And the reason this is important to us is that for lots of us in American culture, faith is often built on family or tradition or peer pressure or emotional or subjective feelings. But when you know your faith is going to cost you everything, you need to know. And it's just been a long time since our faith cost us much of anything in our culture. Now, increasingly, it costs us a little embarrassment, and increasingly, we're thought to be those who maybe aren't the smartest in the world because we do think we know some things. But what kind of thing is knowing? And this is where I'm going to ask you just to think with me a little bit this morning. What kind of thing is knowing? What do we mean when we say to know? What is knowledge? And what is knowledge compared to, for instance, religious belief? Well, to do this, the first thing we have to deal with is we have to deal with the notion of reality, of what is real. And one way to think about what is real is, oh, darn it. Is reality is simply what exists. Reality is what you have to deal with. And mistakes about reality cause untold human pain. From as little to you get in the car one morning, you've got a really important interview to go to maybe, or an important meeting at work, and you look at your gas tank, and it's right on E, and you remind yourself that that doesn't stand for enough. But nevertheless, you think, no, I've done this before. My gas gauge has been at that level before, and I've made it farther than this. I'm quite sure I can make it to work. But you're wrong about reality, and you run out of gas. Here's why. Your gas tank doesn't care what you think about it. It's unmoved by your feelings about how much gas is in there, just like that altar rail is unmoving to my knee. Reality is simply what you have to deal with. And this is what Thomas wanted. He wanted to know what is really real. Okay, so that's the first thing. Just hold that in your mind if you can. That there is a way that things are that are external to our thinking and feeling about it. You got me? That's all I want you to hold in your mind about reality. There just is a way that things are. Now, beliefs are simply what we think about reality. And these beliefs, of course, may be true or false, right? I mean, I don't know about you, but there's probably hardly a day that goes by that I don't think something that's false. Are you with me here? We all think and believe things about reality all day, every day, that are false. And this kind of false thinking, as I said, leads to brutal encounters with reality. So knowledge, then, is simply beliefs that are true. Beliefs are important because only beliefs can govern action. Our thoughts and feelings about things aren't really reliable guides for action. Only knowledge is. That is to say, holding in our minds that which is actually true about a gas tank or an altar rail or anything else. So now I want you to get this. So even the faith of the Bible stories, because I think sometimes when we see that word faith associated with one of the patriarchs or one of the great prophets or one of the great characters in the New Testament, when we see that, I think we often don't know what we're really dealing with there. It's this amorphous kind of thing. What do we mean by faith? Well, even the faith of somebody like Abraham, who it said he left not knowing where he was going. So do you see what's now? You can see what he's saying there. I can't see the reality that's to come. I don't know it. That is to say, I don't have a true representation in my head about what's coming, but he went anyway, and we call that faith. But even that faith was grounded in the experiential knowledge of a person who he knew loved him and cared for him. And so based on a relationship with Yahweh, and the kind of subjective knowledge that comes with knowing a person, he was able to go do what he didn't know. But even the faith of the Bible is always rooted in some sort of knowledge. That what we're talking about here when we're talking about religion is not mere beliefs or tradition. That religion or spirituality is actually a category of knowledge. But society today, especially the Western world that we live in, treats religious beliefs as something other than or less than knowledge. So one of the meanings of the phrase, all religions are equal, what that really means is something like this: all religions are false. and that all religions are unknowable because religion is not a subject of knowledge. At best, it's opinion or it's feelings or professions or traditions or devotion. Or sometimes if people are really being kind to us, they'll say, well, it's sort of myths that have ethical values associated with them. Right? If somebody's being really nice to us. Well, Jesus probably didn't really rise from the dead, but it's a nice thing to hold in your heart. You know, or, you know, Jonah probably wasn't swallowed by a great fish. Or you could just go on and on and on. So if they're being nice to us, they'll say, well, it has some ethical values. And then, of course, in our lifetime, Christians have often responded with harsh dogmatism, with intolerance towards people, even persecution. That, of course, then brings this big counter-reaction, this blowback to us. So that now, with this big argument having been going on between the church and society since really the late 1920s, but especially since post-World War II, and then the 60s, and the advent of a new kind of liberalism, this big, harsh, like marital argument's been happening between the church and the culture, so that now today, the kind of default position is that the answer to religious intolerance must be the denying of knowledge. Because if you say that there is a way that things actually are, then that means we have to deal with it. So rather than having to deal with it and engage in sort of this unpleasant argument with the culture has said, let's just agree that we can't know anything. And the church is being increasingly asked to move into that sort of position. But I just want to say to you this morning, like, really? That's the best we can do as humans? Is let's just agree that there's nothing real? There isn't a way that things are. There is no reality. And I want to just say this morning that I think there's a third way that can include love and peace and tolerance. And it's this very simple idea that we try in all humility, in all modesty, to come to true beliefs about reality. That we do our very best. Now, I've already said there's hardly a day that goes by, I'm sure, that I don't have a false belief about something where I think something's true. It could be as simple as I've got 10 more minutes before this next appointment, but in reality, I only had 3. Are you feeling me here? We all go through all of our days misrepresenting in our minds what's really real. But that doesn't mean there isn't something that's real, right? What do we require of surgeons? Like, could you see Dave Clymer one day saying to Mel, boy, did we get lucky in that one? I'll be darned, that worked. Right? Of surgeons, you require them to have knowledge. Of a therapist, you would require them to have knowledge. Of a car mechanic, you would require them to have knowledge. And so is there a way that we could make our way to something like that when it comes to religion and to spirituality? That we're not just merely lucky in our beliefs. Because here's the deal. It's knowledge that gives the Dave Clymers of the world authority. It's knowledge of your muffler that gives that guy at the shop authority. You actually ask him, what should we do here? And it's because you believe he has knowledge about mufflers that you then grant him the authority of having say over your car. And this is what was happening when Jesus taught. Now, it also, of course, happened when he demonstrated the kingdom. But when Jesus taught, it was not uncommon for crowds to say, we have never heard anyone teach with such authority. Because there was this intuitive sense that Jesus was saying what's really real, and that when he talked about his Father, he wasn't talking about a religious myth. Or then when he talked about the world that had come before him, he wasn't merely talking about a subjective view of history. And when he talked about what was to come in the future, that he was speaking in a way as if he knew what he was talking about. So the ethics of the Sermon on the Mount, the insights of the kingdom parables, his sort of predictions in the Olivet Discourse, you know, at the end of the Synoptic Gospels, that when Jesus talked about such things, people knew. In the same way you know a mechanic or a surgeon has knowledge, they knew that Jesus was speaking out of a body of knowledge. Now, not in the same way that a philosopher or a surgeon or a historian speaks, not in the exact same way, but in that pale. And what the culture wants to do today, and some of us are tempted to do, is to remove ourselves from that pale. And when we do that, we then begin to lack the kind of knowledge that Abraham had that he could act on. And then we have no way to engage our culture in any kind of discussion that's helpful or edifying to them that would actually allow them to move. So how do you do this? First thing, I just want to say simply this, because not a lot we can say here briefly, is that when you begin to ask yourself, well, what is real? I want you to thank God and his kingdom. And that this is the only thing you can really count on, and it is the one thing with which you have to come to terms. And this, of course, is the whole notion of judgment that we can't get into. But at some point, everybody has to come to terms with God. Well, how do you do it? You do so by trusting, by placing your confidence in and following Jesus. You look at him and you think he has authority like those first crowds did, so that you become his student in kingdom living. You make him the master for your life. And to know Christ in this way means to actually know him in your world now, to live interactive with Jesus now in the routines of your daily life, to take his life into your life and to walk with him. Now, this is exceedingly important. I know some of you sitting out there have a little education in philosophy and you're thinking, whoa, look at the bishop busting out some epistemology. This is not about philosophy. This is actually really important human stuff. Because what's happened in recent years in the various genocides around the world, the theater in Denver, the classroom in Connecticut, the gang rapes in India, and the drug cartels in Mexico, these are not one-offs. These are not surprising little flukes or strange things. Listen to me. Those are the natural outcomes of what exists actually in the human heart. Those are not flukish things. Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth does speak, the body does act. No, we can't just give peace a chance. We must change the human heart. And that only happens through something called moral knowledge. And a kind of moral knowledge that's ruled by the love of God and founded on the knowledge of God. Now, I get it that this journey's not easy. And we see in the readings from last week in Easter and this week and this morning that the first friends of Jesus really didn't know what to make of what they were seeing and experiencing. The first reports of the resurrection were perplexing. They seemed stupid, useless, unbelievable. They didn't know what to do with what was happening. It was at a minimum odd. No one raised from the dead. They knew that. It was astonishing. The resurrection, though, as Thomas discovered, did happen. Are you hearing me? No modern rules of evidence can get any stronger or more profound than touch my hands and my side. It actually happened. It is in the realm of knowledge. It's not in the realm of religious belief or myth. It's in the realm of knowledge. Peter went running to the tomb. He looked in. He saw something and he went away marveling. And what I'd like to recover in us this morning is a sense of marvel and love for this Jesus, that we don't have to kind of hide about him or be embarrassed about him, that he sits in the realm of knowledge just like a gas tank or a surgeon looking at a joint of a knee. It's in that same sort of ball of stuff. So that based on the resurrection of Jesus, I want to ask you this morning that you to remind yourself that you can trust him, that you can follow him, that Jesus is worthy of our highest respect, our most sincere devotion, and complete trust. For the resurrection of Jesus demonstrated to his followers that everything he had taught was true. It was the final victory of his embodying through his character, announcing in his teachings, and demonstrating in his deeds that what he taught, lived, and did was true. It gathered all that up from perplexity into something that they could rely on. Come on, what are you relying on to do life? Jesus' first followers in this unbroken chain have said, we think we can rely on Jesus, that he and his Father and the kingdom of God is reality, and we can place our confidence in that. And then lastly, I just want to say, I'm an unabashed Jesus freak. I mean, I love and adore and respect and am proud of Jesus. I mean, come on, if it was you and I, after our resurrection, don't you suppose we would have gone back to Pilate and said, hey, want to have that little chat about truth again? And I just sort of showing up in the courts again and go, what are you thinking now, yo? But he doesn't. Why? Because it's out of his character. It's not the kind of person he was. And this is one of the things that just makes me so proud of him. That from the cross, out of his true nature, he said, Father, forgive them. When he saw human brokenness, he healed it. When he saw people who were distant from his Father, he drew them to him. I am darn proud of Jesus. And no matter what the culture around us says in this moment of time that we happen to be alive, Jesus is to me what is real and he with whom I have to do. And I find that as I have to do with him, he transforms me into his image and my knowledge of reality changes. And that's the journey I invite you in this morning.